ever fully comprehend. It left behind a keen ringing, which had increased as he walked across the city toward the West End, and led him to Tiron. It was strong enough now that Dramad could not only hear Tiron's presence, but feel it as well, as it moved from the rear of the estate to the front entrance. Tiron left on his own, heading north as the city came alive and looked a proper wreck, holding one arm tight to his body, shambling as if every step pained him. And his eyes. Mighty Alu, how empty they looked, how focused on one thing and one thing only, finding more Black Lotus. Ramad ran ahead, taking a parallel route on the dry riverbank's opposite side. He lost sight of Tiron as the Hadar's path curved, and Ramad headed into the shallows proper. The two of them were now headed toward the same place, the Knot, the tattered prince's domain. Soon Ramad spotted Chichio leaning against the wall of a bakery, tearing apart a still-steaming hunk of bread and popping it into his mouth. The two of them didn't acknowledge one another, but as Ramad passed, Chichio fell into step and together they neared the southern entrance to the Knot. They stopped on the near side of a cross-section of streets where the morning crowd grew thick. The ringing sound rose in both pitch and intensity moments before Tiron appeared, limping along as if it were all he could do to keep himself from curling into a ball right there in the middle of the street. He entered the Knot through an arch of sorts formed by the mud brick houses on either side and the oddly angled structure that had been built across their shoulders. It announced the character of the neighborhood every bit as effectively as the bronze-capped pillars that stood at the borders of Golden Hill. Tiron made his way deeper into the Knot, then came to the dead-end street where the tattered prince's territory formally began. As he turned to head along it, Tiron, on cue, glanced back, then played his part perfectly. He stumbled, his eyes went wide, he began moving faster. As he rushed up the street and was lost from view, Ramad moved faster, but not too fast. He turned onto the street and Chichio trailed him. Ahead, Tiron glanced back again. And then Ramad saw the first of them. A woman wearing simple flaxen robes, flanked by a taller man with the look of an enforcer. The woman gave Ramad more pause, however. The palm of her hand, which she had raised to Tiron, was scarred in the shape of a starburst. Ramad had heard about these, the sign of those most loyal to Brahma, but not about the gem embedded there. Like a blue eye, a sapphire gleamed at the center of the scars on her palm. She spoke to Tiron, halting him just as Amaryllis exited a small home where she had had her fortune read, a ruse to ensure she would be along this street at this precise moment. She turned as Ramad drew his sword and headed for Tiron with more speed. Amaryllis gasped loudly, then backed away while pointing at Ramad.
On your guard!
Ramad moved faster.
Traitor!
He shouted at Tiron. Ramad knew Brahma's followers kept the peace here, but he hadn't expected them to rush toward him so aggressively, and he certainly hadn't expected a burst of light to blaze from the gemstone buried in the woman's hand. But that's exactly what happened. As Tiron backed away, shouting,
"Please help!"
the woman strode past him, holding her ruined palm toward Ramad, as if it were a lantern and he a demon in the night. A blue light flashed. Ramad blinked, trying to clear it away, but it wouldn't. It burned like the sun wherever he looked. His world tilted. He heard Amaryllis shouting something, heard Chichio raging until his voice was cut short. heard the scrape of sandals over the sandy street, and saw a scarred hand poised above him. A wave of nausea took him until her palm lowered and touched his forehead. A rush of memories came unbidden, of Khaimir, of sailing the desert, of wandering the endless streets of Sharakai. The memories came faster. A cavalcade of sounds, sights, sensations, followed by a flood of emotions. He could relate to all of them and none of them. Soon it became too much, and he became lost. Chapter 17. Zeheb, the King of Whispers, met Kings Isan and Azad just inside his palace doors.
"Well met," Isan said, giving Zeheb a bow, as did Azad.
"We shall see,"
Zeheb replied, the rolls beneath his chin creasing as he gave a stiff nod and led them down through the palace to its cool lower reaches.
"How fares your daughter?"
Isan asked him.
"Farali died this morning,"
Zeheb said. He said it with as much emotion as he might speak of the weather, yet Isan knew how close they'd been. Farali had been a blade maiden, one of the many sent to verify his whispers or to act on them, but her mission had gone awry. A man she had been sent to question had a slow-acting poisoned needle secreted up his sleeve. She had managed to subdue him and bring him back to Zeheb before being rushed to the matrons for their curatives. For several days all had looked well, but now...
"My tears for your loss,"
Isan replied, genuinely shocked.
"The poison took her?"
"No. She was strong. She fought it off."
Zeheb was angry now. Isan could see it in the stiffness of his strides, the way he swung his arms, as if he wished a weapon was held in each.
"It was the infection. It seemed to be under control, but then it returned, rushing in like a sandstorm. Within a day, she was gone."
Farali's death was yet another test of resolve for Zeheb, the sort every king was forced to contend with sooner or later. Zeheb could have used one of his small cache of the old elixirs, those made by Azad before his death. He could have healed his daughter in moments, but the kings had long ago agreed never to share them. Isan had never once done so, though he had been sorely tempted several times. Some of the kings may have made exceptions, but Isan doubted it. It was one of the more sacrosanct rules they'd agreed to after Bet Iman 4 centuries ago, that only the kings would use them, never others, lest their secrets be discovered. The elixirs were gifts from the gods, meant only for those who were worthy. To share them would not only dishonor the gods, it would surely anger them. And Isan admitted a hoarding mindset had settled in among the kings. Start using them too much, and they wouldn't have enough for themselves. The only exception Isan knew of was Nayan, but having taken Azad's place, she was like to a king and deserved all that went with it. They reached a guarded doorway. The silver spear bowed his head, unlocked the door, and pulled it wide. Zeheb swept in, leaving Isan and Azad to follow. Inside was a clean, unadorned room with a smelly chamber pot in one corner. Wedged into the opposite corner, chained to an iron ring, was a middle-aged man dressed in a bright Malasani kaftan, seer-wool trousers, and fine, if dusty, leather sandals. He was clearly scared, eyes wide, harrowed brow, but otherwise looked unharmed, fresh from the streets. The man's gaze moved to each of the kings in turn, then he seemed to remember himself and shifted to a kneeling position.
"Tell them what you told me,"
Zeheb ordered. The man bowed low, touching forehead to folded hands.
Of course, my lord king. I said Masid Ishagawa is still in the city, and that the remains of the Moonless Host are scared of the king's power. They know their days are numbered. Their leader, Ishak, has already fled the city, but Masid and many of his captains, Hamid the Cruel, Darius One Arm, Shal Alara of the Three Blades, are preparing to leave the city en masse.
And how do you know this? Isan broke in.
A number of them are hiding in my tenements.
His words were so rushed, Isan thought he might start to hyperventilate.
I've only recently stumbled across the information. I proceeded to discover all I could so I might pass it to the Silver Spears and the House of Kings.
He bowed his head again. Was he shivering?
I was preparing to do so when I was so kindly invited here.
He bowed his head and flourished towards Zaheb.
By my Lord King's most gracious servant.
Zaheb crossed his arms over his chest.
And your offer?
I am more than willing to tell you where Masid and his comrades in arms are hiding, or how, and when they plan to leave the city. You need only release me for a day, and you'll have them, my kings. On my word, as a loyal citizen of Sharikai, my word, as a child of the desert, there is no need for you to hold or involve my brother or his wife. They are innocent lambs, both.
Well, that certainly explains why the man is in such pristine condition. If he were to leave and go hunting for information about the host, looking like he'd fallen down a mountain face first, it would make the host suspicious, as would an extended absence from his daily routine, which made it likely that Zaheb had brought him here no more than a day ago.
Let me understand, Isan said. You wish to be released, so that you might serve us Masid Ishagawa on a platter.
The man's eyes lit up.
You have the right of it, my lord king.
Isan turned to Zaheb.
I've heard enough.
Zaheb glanced at Azad, but he only frowned and left the room. Zaheb followed, but Isan tarried for a moment.
Your tenements, do they include the one where a man burst through a brick wall and crushed the maiden's head with an iron pot to escape?
For a moment the man didn't seem to know how to answer, but then he nodded tentatively.
Indeed, your grace, that's one of mine.
Isan clasped his hands behind his back and followed Zaheb, the pieces falling into place. The slum lord was a traitor to the Moonless Host. How could he provide Masid's whereabouts otherwise? But his betrayal signalled more. An unreconcilable rift had formed in the host, with Ishak and his son Masid on one side of it, and Hamzakir on the other. Since his return to the desert, Hamzakir had been peeling away more and more of Ishak's support in the host. The slumlord was but more proof of it. If this man was Hamzakir's, then Zaheb's caution made sense. Acting would now weaken Masid's hold on the city, thereby making Hamzakir's position stronger. It had taken Isan years of careful cultivation to gain the trust of the right people, Zaheb and Azad included, and to begin funneling resources and information to Ishak, so that the Moonless Host could better work against the interests of the kings. Not so long ago, Zaheb wouldn't have thought twice about trying to turn this situation to the advantage of their alliance, but now he hesitated, and Isan had to wonder why.
Are you losing heart, my lord king?
Isan said to Zaheb as the three of them walked down the hall. Zaheb said nothing until they had taken one set of stairs up to an empty landing. Then he spun and jabbed his finger at Isan.
I am not losing heart. You have no idea how close Kiral is to finding us out.
Azad was clearly confused.
What in the wide, great desert are the two of you on about?
The Heb is concerned that if we don't fall in line with Kiral and the rest, we'll be sniffed out and strung up like thieves before the gates.
Azad motioned to the stairs behind them.
And what did our prisoner have to do with any of that?
He is a sacrificial lamb, Isan began. Almost certainly set up for us by Kiral, who, for some unfathomable reason, has decided to back Hamzakir in the Moonless Host's internal war. This leaves us with the difficult choice. Use our lamb to betray the Host's old order, Ishak and Masid, thereby ruining our years of careful work. Or we can use him to find Hamzakir and go against the implicit wishes of Kiral, perhaps exposing ourselves in the process.
Zaheb faced Azad.
The choice is not so complicated as that. We have a chance to cripple the Host. What does it matter if Hamzakir helps? If we fail to seize this opportunity, there's no telling what could happen. Ishak and Hamzakir could come to an accord tomorrow. Let us strike while the opening presents itself.
And Kiral?
Azad asked.
I agree with Isan,
Zaheb said.
Kiral is more worried than ever about betrayal. Let's toss him a bone and let our slumlord betray the Moonless Host, or he may start sniffing in places that would best be left alone.
Azad considered.
Have you heard the whispers from Eventide elsewhere?
That Kiral has evidence of our treason, no. But believe me when I tell you he's wary of everyone, especially after Onur's sudden departure and the stories we've crafted to explain it away.
Zaheb drew breath, his nostrils flaring.
Let me put this plainly, Kiral. In no uncertain terms, is demanding we step in line. If we don't, the things we've done, our aiding of the Moonless Host, will not survive his scrutiny. We're not prepared to oppose him. We must bide our time, especially since we've failed to recreate the elixirs.
Isan had decided there was no reason to tell Zaheb that Azad had managed to perfect a new version of the life-giving elixirs, not least wise because of the likelihood that Zaheb would lose heart. Isan had wondered what he'd do if the day came where Zaheb decided that their pact was no longer in his best interests. He'd never found a satisfactory answer, largely because it would depend on how the pieces lay on the Aban board when that happened.
You play a short game, Isan said. If we cede ground to Hamzakir, we may be handing the keys to the House of Kings to him, instead of taking them for ourselves. This is no short game. What we do pits the two factions of the Moonless Host against one another. It will weaken Hamzakir as well, with little harm to Sharakai. Hamzakir is dangerous, but he is a threat we can deal with in due time.
Isan was tempted to try and persuade Zaheb to lure him back to their side, but there was danger in it. He might very well convince Zaheb to remain bold, but Isan could sense how uncertain he was. Zaheb might change his mind again. If he did, if he thought Isan wouldn't bend to his request to align themselves with Kiral, he might very well offer them up as sacrifices or worse, sent his assassins to present them with a kiss of steel. For now, being seen as pliable was more important than pushing for advantages that may or may not bear fruit.
Rock will break, Isan's father had often told him, but water goes where it will.
Besides, Zaheb was right about one thing. They weren't prepared to oppose Kiral directly, not yet. And the old guard of the Moonless Host, while a useful tool, could be replaced in time. So instead of using his God-given powers to convince Zaheb to remain resilient, he used them for another purpose.
"I see the wisdom in your words," he said while giving the slightest tug on Zaheb's heart. "Better to cut the head from the snake before worrying about its nest."
He'd learned over the years just how much he could draw upon Tulathan's gift without being discovered. He did so now with the care of a master craftsman, using words and expression and tone. Even the set of his body in conjunction with his power, creating a symphony that masked the use of his power. Bowing his head, Isan tugged again.
"Mamsakir will keep, and there's no telling what Masid might do once he leaves the city."
He turned to Azad.
"Wouldn't you agree?"
Azad considered for just the right amount of time, as if he too saw the wisdom in Zaheb's words.
"Very well."
Zaheb looked at them both, as if he had been prepared for more of a fight, and now that it was over wasn't sure what to say.
"Well and good then."
Azad's apathy played in stark contrast to Zaheb's relief.
"Are we done here, my good kings?"
"Yes."
Zaheb was most affable, almost giddy. He led them back upstairs, where Isan and Azad returned to their coach. As it trundled away, Azad regarded Isan levelly, annoyance now marking his features.
"I don't know that the use of your gift was necessary."
For the first time in years, Isan was caught flat-footed.
"You felt that?"
Azad touched his stomach.
"I feel much from you since..."
He left the rest unsaid. The child Nyan carried inside her was hidden by the disguise she now wore, but the babe was there. Had some of his power been passed to her along with his seed? He laughed. In all his years, he would never have even considered the notion.
"Wondrous,"
he said, a genuine laugh filling the cabin, warring with the sound of clopping hooves.
"But it was necessary, for Zaheb to renege is no small thing. He is an honest man. It took much for him to consider abandoning our plans." "Honest or not, if he's gone this far, he's considered betraying us." "Which is precisely why I had to use more than words to convince him."
Azad bowed his head with a hungry look that put Isan on edge.
"We must prepare for the worst."
Isan wasn't sure whether to be nervous or proud. Both, he decided. Nyan was more impulsive than he liked and more bloodthirsty. But those very qualities would see them to the end of his long-laid plans.
"Indeed,"
Isan replied, acknowledging that Zaheb may soon have to join Usam, Kulishan, Mesut and Nayan's father, the true king Azad, all of whom now lay in their crypts, beneath their palaces, their chances to rule the desert lost with their lives. Chapter 18. The Grey Gull, Ardsin's rickety sloop, left the city's western harbour under cover of darkness. They needed to reach the northern harbour by dawn, but with the wind against them, they had to head northwest until they could tack and set a path around the city's rocky northeastern shoulder. Adding to Emery's distress, this was a day when every second mattered. But the wind was meagre, less than meagre. Were the wind to find a friendly breeze to join it, then it might be considered meagre.
"Listen, Maria,"
Emre prayed silently,
I would dream beyond this day. Please lend the weather more ambition than this.
The soothsayer, Ardsin, sat cross-legged on the foredeck, doing his best to hold a wriggling, black terror of a creature with both hands. Another flapped violently in a metal cage beside him. The horrific beasts, Iffins, were the size of a small dog and had two sets of saurian wings and smooth-scaled necks that tapered to eyeless heads. They had no jaws, but instead funnel-shaped mouths with row upon row of needle-sharp teeth. Ardsin curled over the one he held as it squirmed. He spoke gibberish to it like the Malisani witches who whispered to their cats before sending them off to perform some errand.
"Take it,"
Ardsin said to Emre.
"God," Emre thought. "The only thing worse than watching it is holding it."
The infernal thing twisted as Emre grabbed it. Its twin set of wings flapped madly, its head snaked around to snap at hands and wrists. It managed to latch onto the protective gloves he wore several times and once bit through the thick leather. In a moment of panic, Emre slapped the head away, which made it wriggle all the more. Hissing from the pain, Emre held its neck more securely, wondering if he had just made a grave error by letting it blood him. There was no telling what one of Gojin's children might do to him. Track him for days, maybe, perhaps even months or years, then return one moonless night and suck his blood dry. Darius, Hamid, and Frail Lamai stood on the edge of the foredeck, eyeing the gull's crew. Ardsin had promised he would see them through the day, but even so things were tense. Unsurprising when Emre and the others had effectively stolen the ship and threatened to kill their captain unless they obeyed. For now, they were complying with Adsin's orders. Emre consoled himself with the knowledge that he only needed their loyalty a short while longer. The Iffin flapped its bat-like wings again, scratching Emre's face. He held it at arm's length until it had calmed.
"When can I release this fucking thing?"
Ardsin took out the second of the Iffins.
"It won't be much longer."
His words, like his actions, were tranquility itself, which was more than strange considering the position he and his men were in.
"The man is a soothsayer,"
Emre reminded himself for the dozenth time.
"He might know every move he has to make to get through this day with his skin intact."
As if he'd heard Emre's thoughts, Ardsin turned and smiled his calming smile, then ducked his head and spoke softly to the second Iffin, the words as nonsensical as before. The ship rattled and shook, slowing momentarily as it crossed the dry bed of the Hadda. They were now rounding the northwestern shoulder of Sharakai and sailed east-northeast, but gods, it was taking a long while to get anywhere. Every moment they spent sailing toward the harbour endangered another of the host.
"Lash, lend this tepid wind your anger!"
As if he had heard Emre's prayer, Ardsin suddenly lifted the writhing demon and flung it into the air like a sacred dove. The Iffin flapped its wings, sounding like the clouds of bats that plagued the banks of the Hadda in late spring, and headed straight for the entrance to the northern harbour, where a pair of lighthouses stood sentinel, twin brands that mirrored the light of the coming dawn.
"Quickly,"
Ardsin said, holding his hands out to Emre. Emre gladly handed the Iffin over. It wriggled, managed to clamp its teeth on the leather gloves again, but then lost hold as Ardsin cradled it. As the grey gull slid over the sand, the moon grew darker and the eastern horizon brightened. They could see two of the king's patrol ships, several leagues north, and a small yacht stationed at the entrance to the northern harbour. Across the harbour's entrance, strung between the two lighthouses and held up by posts driven into the sand, was a stout chain meant to stop any ships not approved by the king's agents.
Track the Ifin closely,
Ardsen shouted to the pilot.
Aye.
The pilot, a rangy woman with a scar that ran down one cheek and along her neck before being lost beneath her rough-spun shirt, adjusted their heading, making sure the sloop's course and the Ifin's matched. As they came closer to the harbour entrance, however, it became clear that the Ifin was flying a path that would lead them over a raised section of rock.
Here's where it gets interesting, Emery said.
Here's where it gets interesting, Frau Lamai echoed,
his eyes brimming with childlike anticipation. The swathe of stone, harbour and the city beyond looked unreal. A painting on canvas. Ochres and purples and rust dominated the landscape in the early morning light. The stone was mostly flat, with pools of sand contained within its topography, though there were outcroppings of rock as well. No captain in their right mind would run their ship across such terrain, not unless they were desperate or mad. It could cripple the ship, especially if they struck one of the larger stones. Ardsen seemed neither desperate nor mad. Once he had resigned himself to finding a way to save Maseed and the others, he'd set about it with surprising zeal. It was as if he now viewed this mission as a test, perhaps one he had never faced before or ever would again, and had taken it as a personal challenge. If there was one saving grace, it was that the wind had finally picked up. The ship was now moving with proper speed, enough that Emery thought they might actually make it to the harbour. The ship lurched as it struck stone. Emery held tight to a shroud lest he be sent sprawling to the deck. The Ifin flapped and twisted, guiding the ship over several of the larger pools of sand, narrowly bypassing large rocks that would cause serious damage. The ride was rough, and the sudden adjustments made the twin masts sway alarmingly. Ahead, however, was the worst obstacle yet, a ridge that was simply unavoidable.
All hold! Roared the pilot.
Everyone held tight, even Ardsen. The sloop's nose bucked as they crossed the ridge. So steep was the angle that Emery was sure the struts were going to give way when they landed. The ship came down hard, the hull groaning. Everything rattled, including Emery's teeth. Something cracked as the ship's arse end tilted up from the rudder catching the same ridge. Then finally, blessedly, they were past it and into the harbour proper. Off the port side, a bell started ringing on the king's yacht, and the crew rushed to pursue them, their warning being picked up along the quays.
Now!
Ardsen called.
Sail along the piers until the Ifin finds them.
Aye!
The pilot adjusted course starboard toward the docked ships where the Ifin flew well ahead, angling between masts and rigging. It twisted this way and that, looking more like a buzzing fly than the demon Ardsen had somehow found and tamed. It was searching for the ship where Maseed and the others hid. It circled and searched, and as they came ever closer to the end of the line of ships, Emery began to worry that the Ifin wouldn't find them. Then it finally began to flip and dive around the main mast of a caravel.
That's it, Emery said,
and began looking for any signs of the host, both on the deck of the ship and along the sand below. He'd hardly begun when he heard footsteps thumping over the deck behind him. The towering Kundini was barreling toward him, a slim knife in his hand that was already speeding toward Emery's neck. Emery jerked backward and felt a burning sensation run in a line across his neck. From the corner of his eye, he could see the other crewmen rushing the foredeck. They'd been relieved of their weapons earlier, but they'd found makeshift clubs or belaying pins to fight with.
Stop!
Ardsen shouted, throwing the second Ifin into the air.
All of you, stop immediately!
The Kunduni stayed his next swing, staring at Adsin in wide-eyed disbelief. The rest of the crew did the same.
"We've taken a commission,"
Adsin went on,
"and we will fulfill it. Back to your stations."
The crew frowned, visibly reluctant.
"Man this ship!"
Adsin shouted. Only then did they obey, albeit slowly. Oxan, the mountainous Kunduni, glared at Emre, daring him to attack, but then slipped the knife up his sleeve. Emre grimaced as he touched his hand to the shallow cut he'd taken from Oxan's knife. As he pressed his sleeve to it, the others returned to the work of guiding the ship around the harbor's curving interior. Adsin, meanwhile, watched as the second Ifin wheeled higher into the gauzy yellow sky, as if he had no doubt the mythical beast would lead him and his crew to safety.
"There they are,"
Darius said, pointing toward the caravel. Emre spotted them beneath the pier. A dozen men and women in thobes, dresses, and leather armor were emerging from the caravel's lower hatch. Masid was at their head, his twin shamshirs hanging from his belt. In that same moment, the first Ifin released a piercing screech and flew west, its mission fulfilled.
"Slow the ship," Hamid called.
Adsin's crew was already at the gull's stern, lowering the iron-toothed rake. It thumped into the sand, digging deep furrows, slowing the ship and throwing everyone forward. Masid's confusion was plain.
"Quickly," Hamid called. "We've been betrayed."
A black arrow thudded into the back of the woman standing behind Masid. Another arrow took the man beside her in the thigh, and then suddenly the air was thick with them. Emre ducked behind the gunwales as arrows streaked in against the grey gull. Beyond the quay, 15 blade maidens wearing turbans and black fighting dresses and a score of silver spears in conical helms and lapping chainmail hauberks surged forth from a warehouse. Many held bows and stopped to launch volleys, but five of the blade maidens were sprinting ahead, ebon blades drawn. Emre wondered if Chader was among them, but he had no time to look more closely. Darius was handing him a bow. While Masid ushered those following him toward the grey gull, Emre loosed arrow after arrow into the sprinting blade maidens. Emre had deadly aim, but the maidens were amazingly quick and seemed to know exactly where he was aiming. Each time he released an arrow, they would dodge out of the way, hardly slowing in the process. So it was that with the first six shots he managed only one grazing wound. The maidens hurtled along the pier and dropped to the sand as the grey gull approached those fleeing the caravel.
"Port side!"
Emre shouted, waving frantically to them.
"Move to the port side of the ship!"
They took his meaning. Many flew across the sand and beyond the gull's prow, where they grabbed at the ladders and ropes that Frail Lamai had lowered for them. Others turned and confronted the maidens rather than be cut down from behind. Swords clashed as the scarabs of the Moonless Host met the line of blade maidens. At first, the maidens were severely outnumbered. 2 dozen scarabs stood against their 5, but the maidens worked in effortless concert, moving easily with one another as if they were a single 5-headed black-skinned beast, a demon not unlike the Ifin that had led the grey gull to dockside. Arrows continued to rain down, but now the gull's crew joined in the counterattack. All knew the grisly fate that awaited them if they didn't escape this harbor. So they accepted the bows Hamid handed them and pulled arrows from the quivers stationed around the ship, loosing them with a zeal that matched Emre's. Adsin was pointing madly to the second Ifin, spinning in a tight circle near the mouth of the harbor.
"Quickly! Pull up the rake!"
The crew did, though one of them took an arrow in the arm for the trouble. Another arrow came screaming in and took the pilot straight through the neck. The woman grabbed it, trying to pull it free, but the moment she succeeded, a torrent of blood gushed from the wound, and she fell writhing to the deck. Oxan grabbed the wheel, steering them back on a heading even with the Ifin's path, while the rest of the crew set the boom for the coming change in wind. Emre and Hamid rushed to the stern to get a better view of the battle, to help if they could. Several scarabs fought around Masid, but two had already fallen. A third had his legs cut from underneath him as the maiden he was fighting ducked and delivered a vicious two-handed strike across his knees. A heavy thud sounded to Emre's right as the ballista fired. The bolt struck low, creating a burst of sand in front of the two blade maidens sprinting past Masid toward the grey gull. The sudden spray of sand slowed them, but not by much. If even one of them gained the ship, they could easily cripple it. Emre turned as Senk, Ardzin's second mate, began cranking the ballista's windlass again. By his side were more of the larger bolts, but also a grapnel and a coil of rope. It was usually launched across rigging to cripple enemy ships, but the sight of it gave Emre a flash of inspiration.
"Give me a turn," Emre said.
Senk grudgingly allowed him to lay the grapnel and rope into the bolt groove. Emre aimed high and fired. As the grapnel flew and the coil unfurled behind it, Emre whistled sharply twice. Masid glanced back, then redoubled his efforts against the two blade maidens, his twin shamshirs flying. The grapnel flew by him and would have caught the maiden on his right across the head had she not somehow sensed it and ducked in time. The rope pulled taut and the grapnel raked the sand. It tripped the maiden, who cried out as one of the grapnel's sharp hooks tore through her foot, boot and all, and dropped her to the sand. It pulled her along as she reached for it, trying vainly to release herself. Masid gave one last flurry of sweeping blows from his shamshirs, then turned and sprinted for the maiden being dragged ever faster by the ship. Sheathing one of his swords with practiced ease, he ran onto the maiden, using her as a platform to launch himself forward. Grappling the rope with his free hand, he sliced it clean through so that the maiden was freed, and he was now being pulled along the sand. Emre and Hamid worked together, hauling Masid closer and closer to the ship as the remaining maiden gave chase. Darius fired arrow after arrow at her, forcing her to alter her path, but it still wasn't enough. She lifted her sword, preparing to leap and chop her blade down against Masid, when another thud from the second ballista sounded and a bolt caught her straight through the chest. The blow was so powerful it knocked her backward and pinned her against the sand. Hamid and Emre were both beginning to tire, but luckily Frail Lamai rushed in to relieve them. Alone, he pulled the rope with his cordwood arms, drawing Masid closer to the ship with more speed than Emre and Hamid had managed together. Finally, Masid was up and over the edge of the gunwales, breathing hard, his legs bloody where sand and stone had torn through his clothes. Another of Ardzin's crew was felled by an arrow, but the grey gull was building speed now and heading toward open sand. The royal yacht guarding the harbour's entrance had set its sails and was gliding toward the rocky area where the gull had entered the harbour. They clearly thought to cut off their escape.
"Where's the Ifin?" Emre snapped.
Oxan, at the pilot's wheel, squinted at the sand ahead, the sky above.
"It was the star," he said in a thick Kundanese accent. "I swear it."
Before he'd even finished the words, Emre heard urgent flapping to his left. He turned and saw the Ifin arcing toward them. It fluttered around Masid, then landed on one of his swords. It gripped the scabbard, its head twisting this way and that as if it were confused.
"Go!"
Hamid shouted, waving his hands at it, but it only fluttered away and landed on the sword again. Only when Masid drew the sword did it fly, turning in tight circles, and saw ahead of the ship directly for the center of the long chain spanning the mouth of the harbor.
"What's it want, Embre?"
Frau Lamai asked. Hamid frowned at Frau Lamai and headed to the foredeck while staring at the Ifin.
"Does the thing expect us to just run past the chain? It'll shatter the struts."
Emre watched the odd patterns of the Ifin's flight as Hamid grabbed Ardzin by the front of his robes and shook him.
"What does that ruddy thing want?"
Ardzin, practically ignoring Hamid, was staring every bit as intently as Emre.
"I don't know." "It's your bloody beast," Hamid pressed.
Ardzin turned to him and replied as if he was speaking to a child.
"I have no special insight into their minds. Once given a scent, they follow it, trusting wholly to the winds of fate. How they reveal it is up to them and is for us to interpret." "It wants us to break the chain," Emre said.
"What?"
Masid asked, stepping alongside them.
"Look at it! It wants us to break the chain."
The Ifin was darting down toward one particular spot in the long, black chain, swooping up, then doing the same. Over and over it repeated the maneuver, a thing not unlike a sword cutting across it. Emre turned to Masid.
"Give me your sword."
Hamid barked a laugh.
"You're mad."
But Masid had no humor in his eyes as he glanced between the Ifin and his Shamshir, which he still held in his right hand. It was a fine weapon, every bit as beautifully crafted as the maiden's ebon blades. It was darker than normal steel, the materials that went into forging ebon steel, perhaps a part of its alchemical making. The ship was getting closer and closer to the chain. The sound of the skis over the sand came like a hiss now that they were picking up good speed. Senk, Ardzin's man, had come near. He was staring in awe at the Ifin.
"Best bloody do it if you're going to."
Hamid looked incensed, but Masid nodded and handed the weapon to Emre, who headed for the prow, where he hopped up to the bowsprit. Navigating the foot of the jib, then the flying jib, he made it to the very fore of the beam and held himself in place with a stay line. He crouched and waited as the gull approached the chain. Gods, how fast the ship was moving now, the waves of sand below accentuated by shadows from the sunrise. The Ifin was still swooping, but as the grey gull came near, it flew beneath the ship like an arrow. Emre took a deep breath, exhaled sharply, and leapt. Taking the sword in both hands, he brought it down with all his might against the black length of the chain. He heard a metallic shearing, felt the chain give way, and the sword bite into the sand below. And then the ship loomed above him. The forward struts struck the chain. Chips of wood flew as the chain's two halves were whipped to either side of the ship, but the struts held and the gull sailed on. Emre knew what the Ifin wanted him to do. The rudder was flying toward him with alarming speed. He tried his best to soften the blow as he threw himself across it, but it still drove mercilessly into his ribs. He heard something snap and saw stars as he held tight to the ski. He was horrified to realize he had lost Masid's sword. It lay in the sand, falling away as the ship headed past the lighthouses. He nearly let himself slip off the rudder. He might be able to grab the sword and run back to the ship if they slowed for him, but he may as well wish to be king of Sharakai. The pain in his ribs was already beginning to soar. Soon the access hatch on the bottom of the ship was being opened, and Emre was making his way slowly, gingerly toward it, using the handholds in the stout wood of the strut. He was practically yanked through the opening by Frau Lamai.
"Careful, Lamai!"
Blackness began to close in around him.
"Broken ribs!"
Frail Lamai hardly seemed to notice, smiling broadly, though he thankfully took more care after that, helping Emre up along two ladders and back to the deck. Everyone on deck was smiling, even Ardsin, especially Ardsin, though the man must know the hour of his reckoning was near. They sailed throughout the day, still following the Ifin, whose job with the capital ship, a clipper, having joined the royal yacht in chasing them, was not yet done. Over and over it led them across rocky terrain, but chose the safest path possible, necessitating that the yacht and clipper slow down or risk running aground. Over the course of the day they fell farther and farther behind, and were finally lost altogether. The grey gull sailed on through the night, the Ifin still flying close enough that they could see it by moonlight, and when the moons set they followed the sound of its flapping wings. When morning came it flapped up and away, and Masid called for a halt. He ordered that Ardsin and the five remaining members of his crew be brought before him on the sand. They were lined up, surrounded by the host's survivors, Ardsin standing two steps ahead of them.
"I've heard the whole tale," Masid said simply. "You betrayed the moonless host."
"One might look at it that way," Ardsin replied. His words were deadened in the cold morning air.
"There's no other way to look at it," Hamid broke in.
Masid raised his hand to him.
"Is there another way?"
Ardsin spread his hands and bowed his head, a supplicant before a mighty king.
"To truly know, you'd have to see all the other possible paths of fate."
Hamid frowned.
"And you saw them, these other paths?"
Ardsin gave him a placid smile.
"For you and those gathered here, there were few enough to see."
"You knew it would come to this," Hamid said.
He was gripping the hilt of his shamshir. The deep-seated rage in him was clear, but Masid seemed to discount it. He merely raised one hand to forestall Hamid, keeping his eyes on Ardsin. Ardsin, meanwhile, nodded.
"The other paths were less agreeable than this one."
In that moment, Hamid gripped his sword and drew, closing the distance between him and Ardsin as he did. Masid moved to intercept, but his hand reached for his favored shamshir, the one that was now lost because of Emre. Hamid roared as he brought his blade, flashing in the sun against Ardsin's throat. Blood flew. For a moment, everyone stared. Ardsin fell to his knees, gripping the wound, his eyes wide, disbelieving at last. He collapsed, quivering to the sand, his lifeblood spilling crimson down the slope of the amber dune.
"You bloody fucking goat!"
Masid yelled at Hamid, who hadn't yet taken his eyes off of Ardsin.
"Go!"
Masid yelled again, shoving him into motion.
"Go!"
Craning his head back, Hamid spit at Ardsin's twitching form, then marched over the sand, sheathing his sword as he went. Ardsin's crew stared on with shock or barely suppressed rage. Oksan, the quiet giant, looked as if he were ready to explode in fury. Masid's jaw jutted as he struggled to recover himself. He looked to each of the crewmen in turn, offering no apology but saying instead,
"Your lives are worthless in Sharakai. We'll give you our skiff and enough food and water to reach a caravanserai. Then you can see where your fortunes take you."
A beetle's wings rattled in the distance. Oksan stood tall, meeting Masid's stare with an expression of stony hatred.
"The host is a plague upon the desert."
For several long moments no one spoke. Emre was certain violence would erupt again, but then Senk moved to stand in front of Oksan. He had no less hatred on his face, but his words were more politic.
"We'll take the skiff."
Masid nodded, then turned to Emre.
See that it's done.
Emre did, loading enough provisions for 7 days, sail, a map, and instruments to sail by. Ardsin's crew, meanwhile, were allowed to bury Ardsin's body in the sand. On the ship, meanwhile, a hellacious shouting match played out in the captain's cabin of the Gull, Masid and Hamid coming to terms. Soon Ardsin's 5 surviving crewmen were sailing away. As the sun rose in the east and the grey Gull set sail for the eastern desert, the skiff was lost beyond the horizon. Chapter 19. A week after venturing into the blooming fields with Sukru, Davood sat on his patio after dusk, penning a letter to his sister, Taylor, by lamplight. The day after his visit to the blooming fields, the palace steward had told him he could write a handful of letters. He was certain they'd be read before delivery, but he'd still be glad to get news to Taylor and his family, any news, since his return from Ishmantep. So far, all Sukru had allowed was a messenger to say he had survived and was a guest of the king's. He hoped that if he continued to please the king, his family would be allowed to visit him, or maybe he'd be able to visit them. Tulathan's bright smile, how he had loved to spend a day baking bread with Taylor. He'd thought it tedious when he was young, but he could do with a bit of tedium now. He stopped his writing as the nearby lamp shed light on a familiar bright-breasted finch flitting about the branches of the fig tree. As he set the vulture quill into the inkwell, he realized the bird had something in its beak. It wasn't a bit of twig this time, nor a leaf. It was a small, perfect triangle. He beckoned and said, "Come! Come, there's no need to be shy." And the bird flew down onto the mosaic tabletop and dropped the triangle near his wine glass. As it hopped away, Davood picked up the golden device and was stunned by how heavy it was. The finch spun, then tapped its beak on the tabletop, then again, and a third time. Davood, brow furrowing, set one point of the triangle on the tabletop. The bird tapped and spun, tapped and spun. Curious, Davood gave the thing a spin. It spun and wobbled, looking ready to topple, but it didn't. It continued to spin, a whisper above the table's surface, glinting in the lamplight as it turned faster and faster like a child's top. Slowly it lifted into the air until it was nearly eye level. Davood shivered as the thing began to speak in a soft voice. "So, we meet at last." The voice had a strange vibrato. Was the spinning causing it? He wasn't sure, but it made it impossible to determine whether the speaker was a man or a woman. After glancing about for signs of Anila or Xander or anyone else watching, he turned back to the spinning triangle. It felt strange to speak to it, but what else was there to do?
"Who are you?"
"You may call me the Sparrow."
With the speed of it increased, the vibrato had somehow lessened.
"Very well, but who are you, really?"
"Too soon for such talk. Let me instead tell you what I know about you."
As the voice spoke, the triangle sped up and slowed down. Faster when the voice was strongest, slower during lulls or when the voice had fallen silent. He decided the voice sounded male.
"You are one of 2 scholars known to have survived the massacre on the college grounds. You either escaped or were spared in Ishmantep. The same is true of the woman, Anila, who shares your room in the Reaping King's palace. You were awakened to the red ways in the desert, and I can only assume it was Hamzakir himself who gave you that spark. You make it your business to know those awakened to the red ways."
Davood felt more watched than ever and wanted to get the Sparrow talking about himself.
"I do.
A warbling chuckle came from the spinning device.
I do, indeed. I consider it my calling. What else can you surmise?
Davood remembered what Hamzakir had told him out in the desert, that he should find a mage to learn from, before one found him.
I can only